Un speech con el acento de la reina de Inglaterra. El quinto día recita Shakespeare con gracia y soltura. El sexto día ya piensas en inglés.
¿Y el séptimo día qué? ¿Descansas?
No, no. Al séptimo día ya estás de vuelta en casa con un nivel de inglés mucho mejor. Ven a Vaughan Town, un lugar en el que 6 días equivalen a 500 horas de clase de inglés. Vivirás en un entorno 100% angloparlante en el que tenemos un gran número de actividades para que desarrolles tu inglés, te sueltes y te olvides de la timidez. Vence a la vergüenza en Vaughan Town y mejora tu nivel de inglés. Llama ahora al 91-133-5833 o entra en grupovaughan.com.
Las mañanas son más productivas con Richard Vaughan.
You're listening to Richard Vaughan Live.
Welcome, good morning. Yes, good morning to a new edition of Richard Vaughan Live, Wednesday's edition. Yes, sir. We're nearing the end of the month. We're approaching the end of the month, which means the end of the month is getting closer and closer. And the beginning of the month of March is getting farther and farther away. Closer to, farther from. Yes, and that's the inexorable passage of time, inexorable. We say inexorable. You can't stop time. Well, at least with the technology we have now, we can't stop time. But here we are in the morning, and it's time to continue learning English. Present perfect, why not? Let's do some present perfect stuff. No, Richard, I don't want to do the present perfect. I want to do the simple past. Yeah. Yeah, why talk about the past? That's water under the bridge. Excuse me? The past is water under the bridge. What does that mean? Well, you have a similar expression in Spanish, which is even better. Agua pasada no mueve molino. Es agua pasada. So we say es agua debajo del puente, que ha pasado. It's water under the bridge. Ha pasado por debajo del puente. It's water under the bridge, the past. Yes, but I want to dwell on the past. You want to dwell on the past? That's not a very good idea. Besides, do you understand the verb to dwell? Kind of. O sea, más o menos. Well, how do you spell it? Se escribe como well. Estoy bien, gracias. I'm very well. Con D delante, dwell. And what does it mean? Well, it means morar. Morar. ¿Dónde moras? Yo moro en Madrid. Okay. Mi humilde morada. My humble dwelling. I dwell. So yes, dwell is a verb that means to live, but it's usually used by anthropologists or archaeologists talking about ancient cultures or ancient communities and their dwellings, sus moradas, los antiguos moradores, the old dwellers, cliff dwellers in the United States, in Arizona and New Mexico. There's some interesting Indian communities from 500 years ago or 1,000 years ago. And they're called cliff dwellings. And the Indians were called the cliff dwellers. Cliff, C-L-I-F-F, means precipicio, acantilado, terraplén, cliff. Cliff, the white cliffs of Dover. Cliff dwellers, dwellers, doble L. And you can see pictures of it. It's quite impressive. These Indians built their little villages into the side of cliffs. for protection. So apparently these Indians were not aggressive. They were rather passive Indians. And they were living around other, perhaps more aggressive Indian tribes. And so they protected themselves by building their homes, their dwellings into, fíjate, digo, building into, say, entrando en la cara de un precipicio, medio la construcción. And so you see cliff dwellings. So you say you don't, I'm telling you, but to dwell has a second meaning. And it's a figurative meaning. Don't dwell on the past means no mores sobre el pasado, literalmente. It means no te pares, no dejes que el pasado, how do you say, more dentro de ti, o sea, que te, don't, it's water under the bridge. Don't dwell on things that you can't change. It's too late to dwell on a subject. For example, right now, I'm dwelling on the subject of the verb to dwell. Estoy parando como un helicóptero sobre el tema. Imagine on the ground, there are several subjects. And there's a helicopter, and the helicopter stops and hovers above a certain subject. And so we could say the people in the helicopter are dwelling on that subject. They're talking about that subject. Don't dwell on the past. ¿Sí? Se usa mucho el verbo to dwell cuando dices, no te pares a pensar demasiado en el pasado. Yes. Don't dwell on the past. I was planning to teach the present perfect. Yeah, but I want to do the past. Well, let's reach a Solomonic solution here. Solomonic? Yeah, Solomon. All right. Which means half and half. Half and half. But I don't understand. Decisión Salomónica. Yeah, what does that mean? Well, it comes from Solomon. You know, Solomon was one of the sons of King David, and he was the heir, and he inherited the throne of Israel from his father, King David. And he became King Solomon, and he is considered to be a very wise king. He chose wisdom over wealth, although he became extremely wealthy, according to the Bible. And he was also, back in those days, the leader was also the supreme judge. In many cases, el juez supremo. And so he had to make judicial decisions. And there was one moment in which a baby was claimed by two different women. Two different mothers claimed that the baby was theirs. And it was impossible to know because, of course, Solomon and the Israelites didn't have DNA testing at that time. Ensayos por ADN. DNA testing didn't exist back then. And they, not even blood tests to know if it was tipo A, grupo sanguíneo. They didn't have these things. So they couldn't really tell, you know. So Solomon couldn't tell if the baby belonged to one mother, one woman, or to another woman. And it was impossible. Finally, he said, okay, I have a solution. We will cut the baby in half. I'll take my sword, with doble muda, no sword. I'll take my sword, I'll cut the baby in half. And we'll give one half to you and one half to the other here. And the one of the women said, no, you don't do that. You can leave the baby with the other woman. And immediately Solomon knew that that was the real mother. She was more willing to allow the baby to go with another woman than to allow the baby to be killed. And so Solomon solved it. That's the origin of the concept of Solomonic decision. So we need to make a decision about the simple past and the present perfect. My God, that's a tough decision. I don't know which is more important. Come on, Richard, the simple past is more important. We use it more often than the present perfect. Maybe. You know, I don't know. You know, it's interesting that I've never performed the study. I've never studied how much we actually use a given verb tense. I would say that we probably use the present tense maybe 60% of the time. 60% of the time we use the present tense, understanding the present tense as the present simple and the present continuous. Fumo, estoy fumando. All right. I would say maybe, I would say maybe 50% of the time. And I would say that we use the imperative 10% of the time. That could be the direct imperative, tráeme un vaso de agua, or the polite imperative. ¿Puedes traer un vaso de agua, por favor? The polite imperative. Maybe, so 60% is the present tense and the imperatives, direct and polite. And I would say that the going to future and the will, the future, with going to, with will and the present continuous used as future. Mañana voy a la playa, tomorrow I'm going to the beach. Tomorrow I'm flying to Barcelona. Mañana voy en avión a Barcelona. Tomorrow I'm flying to Barcelona. I would say that's another 10%. And so I would say the simple past, I really don't know. Somebody should do that, you know, to find out. Because when we teach a language, really we should spend more time on the areas of the language that are used the most. And less time, for example, the most enjoyable verb tense to teach, the verb tense that is the most fun to teach is the conditional. If you were the president of Spain, would you raise taxes? If you had $1 million, would you buy a Rolls Royce? And you, all of these hypothetical questions. And the student struggles with the structure. It's a lot of fun. It's challenging for the student, and it's fun for the teacher. But we use the conditional 3% of the time. So it's not necessarily the best approach to teaching English, is dwelling on a verb tense that is used only 3% of the time. Interesting stuff. But past tense and present perfect. Well, let's start with the past. Okay, for who's, you know, the most important person in history. Well, the most important person in history, well, it depends. If you're Christian or if you're from Western civilization, you would say Jesus of Nazareth. Yeah, Jesus of Nazareth. When was he born? He was born in 5 BC. When did he die? He died in 30 AD. Oh, he lived 35 years? I thought he died when he was 33. Well, the historians are changing these things because historians are paying attention to what was happening in the Roman Empire at the same time. And the idea is maybe he was 35. So he died in 30 AD. Okay, he died in 30 AD. Fine. So how long has he been dead? Do you want me to calculate that? Well, we're in the year 2023, and he's been dead for 1,993 years. Ah, okay, that's the present perfect. So you see, you use the simple past and the present perfect. He died in 30 AD, and that was 1,993 years ago, so he's been dead for 1,993 years. Well, if you're a Christian, you would be reluctant to say that Jesus of Nazareth is dead. If you're a devout Christian, you would say that he is living inside of you and me and all of us. Well, what about Muhammad? Muhammad, he's the prophet of Islam. Yes. It's interesting, in Spanish, people say Mahoma. It's really incorrect. Should be Muhammad or Muhammad, because Mahoma is a despective term originally for the prophet in Spanish. Mahoma. It's interesting about Mahoma. Let's see. If I can find the origin of the word. Let's see. It's Muhammad. Muhammad is the correct, I think the correct. Pero se hispanifica como Mahoma. All right. Somewhere I read a long time ago that Mahoma es un nombre despectivo para él. Yes, Mahoma o Muhammad. All right, here we have it. So, oof, it's a very long article, forget it. Yes. So, I can't find the answer. But I think it's not correct. I think the word Mahoma is an incorrect derivation of Muhammad. So, whatever. You can look it up. If you're interested in that subject, yes. Let's see. I'm still trying to find it. La palabra Mahoma es el nombre castellanizado de Muhammad in Arabic. All right. Well, maybe it's not despective. Maybe it's not. Somewhere I read that or heard that, but nevertheless, let's go on. So, when was he born? He was born in 570 A.D. Richard, what does A.D. stand for? A.D. stands for Anno Domini, el año, the year of our Lord, Anno Domini. And what does B.C. stand for? B.C. stands for before Christ. Oh, now the many scientists and researchers and anthropologists and historians have stopped using the B.C. and A.D. reference because there's religious connotation to it. And they use BCE and CE. So we could say, for example, that, I don't know, Buddha, for example, Buddha, the spiritual teacher and the founder of Buddhism, was born in 563 BCE. Yeah, but what does that stand for? BCE? What does BCE stand for? Yeah, what does it stand for? Before the Common Era. Antes de la Era Común. Before the Common Era. So Buddha was born in 563 BCE, and he died in 483 BCE, because we count backwards in this way. Now, we can say that Muhammad was born in 570 CE, Common Era. And more you see that in different texts, in different types of compositions and texts. So Muhammad, how long did he live? I don't know. Well, if he was born in 570 and he died in 632, then he lived probably 61 or 62 years. It depends on what month. So he died at the age of 62 at the oldest, at the latest. Yes, but where did he die? I don't know. Probably in Mecca. Where was he born? I think he was born in Mecca. All right. And what was the most important year for him? 622, 10 years before he died. And what was so important about 622? Oh, that's the year in which he failed to convert the people in Mecca to his new religion. And he had to escape Mecca, and he went to Medina. Medina's about 5 hours away by train or by, I don't know how, I think it's similar to Madrid, Barcelona in distance. We can find out. And that's called the Hegira, Ejida or Hegira. And that's considered the beginning of the Muslim religion, the faith of Islam. And that's the Hegira. But I want to find out. I think it's about 500 kilometers. It could be more. Let's look for Mecca. In English, it's spelled with a double C. M-E-C-C-A. Mecca. Mecca. All right. I can't go to Mecca because I'm not Muslim. And let's find out the distance to Medina. Ni no Medina Campo. Ni Medina Celi. meaning Arabia Saudita. Distance is, let's see, 453 kilometers. All right. I was right. I said 500 kilometers. Barcelona, from Barcelona to Madrid, we're talking of 600 kilometers, 610 perhaps. So it's not quite as far, not quite as far as it is from Madrid to Barcelona. So 453 kilometers. All right. And it takes by car 4 hours, 4.5 hours, 4.5 hours. You can take an illegal 4.5 hours. 4.5 hours. I've never been there. I've never been to Saudi Arabia. Although a friend of mine is a person I know, fantastic person, is the ambassador, the Spanish ambassador to Riyadh. So, but I've never been. So it's probably a very interesting country, but maybe in my next life, or maybe in this life, it depends if somebody invites me. Maybe my friend, if somebody invites me, but it's a big country. And the population, I think, is around 40 million people, but I'm not sure. What's the population of Saudi Arabia? Well, I can make an educated guess. I would say it's 40 million. Saudi Arabia. Let's check. Arabia Saudita, Saudi Arabia. Population, 37 million. Oh, I was pretty close. Pretty means bastante. I was pretty close. Yes, 37 million people in Saudi Arabia. It's a lot of people, given that most of the Arabian Peninsula is a desert. And what's the biggest city? Well, I think the biggest city is Riyadh. And what's the second biggest city? I think it's Jeddah, on the coast or near the coast of the Red Sea. Ranking Saudi cities by population, and we'll find out. I think Riyadh's probably bigger, but I'm not sure. Riyadh is the biggest, 4.2 million. So there are more people in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, than in Madrid, because the population of Madrid proper is Madrid propiamente dicho, Madrid. In Spanish, you say Madrid, término municipal. Madrid, Spain, Madrid. Here we are. The population of Madrid is, come on, open up. Open up, no me abre. Open up. Population, 3.3 million. Of course, Greater Madrid is 6.5 million or 6.8 million. The community, what we call the province of Madrid, is about 6.8 or 6.9 million people. But the city itself is not that big in population. So Riyadh as a city is bigger. The second biggest city in Saudi Arabia is Jeddah. With 2.9 million, close to 3 million people. And then Mecca has 1.3 million and Medina has 1.3 million. All right. I'll never go to Mecca because I'm not allowed to go to Mecca. I'm not sure about Medina. You know, can non-Muslims go visit Medina? Unlike Mecca, Medina is open to everyone, including non-Muslims. All right. Non-Muslims used to be banned from Al-Haram, the city center, but this rule was relaxed in 2021. So non-Muslim tourists may now head up all the way to the perimeter fence of the Prophet's Mosque and take photos from the outside. All right. Yes. Can non-Muslims visit Mecca? No, sir. In Mecca, only Muslims are allowed, while non-Muslims may enter or pass through. While non-Muslims may not enter or pass through. Attempting to enter Mecca as a non-Muslim can result in penalties such as a fine. Can you imagine the Rome? Imagine Rome being, pretty, you know, only Christians can go to the city of Rome or to the Vatican. All right. So they are more radical in their ways. I don't know. And the capital of Buddhism, I don't know what the capital of Buddhism, I really don't know what it is. Shanxi has the world's Buddhist temple gym. I don't even know where that is. The world's Buddhism capital, Shanxi, where is it? I've never heard of this. You know, I've never heard of this. Let's find it on a map. Shanxi, it's in China. Where in China? Shanxi. Okay, it's in an area in central China. I did not know that that was the capital of Buddhism. Because Buddhism started in India, I believe, and Nepal in that area. Yes. So, I'm learning new things today, but weren't we supposed to talk about the present perfect and the simple past? Yes, but we've run out of time. Well, maybe in the next half hour. I'll be right back.
¿Quieres que tus hijos disfruten de unas vacaciones inolvidables mientras aprenden inglés? Apúntalos a nuestros campamentos. Más información en grupovaughan.com.
Aprender a comunicarse en inglés para lograr afrontar situaciones en inglés tanto en el terreno personal como en el profesional, adquirir un dominio privilegiado del idioma que le permita completar su desarrollo profesional. Hay un producto que le garantice todo esto.
Al entrar en el mercado laboral, lo único que cuenta es ser más atractivo que otros candidatos, gozar de mayor estimación. Y el aspecto que más impacta a una empresa cuando mira un candidato joven es su nivel de inglés. Si es muy alto, es contratado. Si no lo es, pues no. Aunque sea el número uno en su promoción, nuestro MIP, nuestro Máster en Inglés Profesional, resuelve este tema para el candidato.
Máster en Inglés Profesional de Vaughan. Infórmese en el 911-335-833. 911-335-833.
Who are you? I'm Richard Vaughan. What do you do? I teach. Oh, what do you teach? I teach English. Who do you teach? I teach Spanish people, usually, sometimes other nationalities. Why do you teach? Because it's fun. Only because it's fun? Yes, because it's fun. You sound selfish. And your students? Well, if it's fun for me, it's fun for them. It becomes contagious. The English language becomes contagious. The students become addicted, and finally, they master the language. It's a logical process. Don't you agree?
Porque aprenden, disfrutan, conviven, juegan, experimentan, hacen amigos y lo más importante, asimilan el idioma de forma natural y pierden el miedo a hablar, abriéndose paso en este complicado mundo de la comunicación en inglés. Así son los campamentos de verano Vaughan. Cada año más de 3.000 familias confían en nosotros para el aprendizaje del inglés de sus hijos en los distintos tipos de campamentos que ofrecemos. Por ejemplo,
programa completo de inmersión en inglés con alojamiento incluido. Tus hijos hablan. Hablarán inglés durante todo el día mientras participan en talleres, juegos y actividades deportivas y multiaventura. Y todo eso sin clases. Todas las modalidades de campamentos Vaughan están diseñados para niños y niñas entre 6 y 15 años, independientemente de la programación o la instalación. En nuestros campamentos de inglés se acostumbran a utilizar el inglés sin miedo y con total confianza, en un entorno rural, acogedor y seguro. La coordinación pedagógica de Vaughan asegura un ambiente de inversión, cuidado y de calidad.
Tráelos a nuestros campamentos de verano en inglés. 911-335-832. 911-335-832. Ahora con nuevas facilidades de pago. Agua a plazos sin intereses. Llámanos al 911-335-832. Campamentos de verano Vaughan. El líder del sector. 911-335-832. No lo dejes para el último momento. Aprenderán inglés mientras viven mil aventuras. No olvides preguntar por el resto de campamentos e inversiones de la línea Junior de Vaughan.
En los Urban Camps tenemos un montón de aventuras y temáticas disponibles y todo sin que los peques tengan que dormir fuera de casa. Tu reserva ya en campamentosvaughan.com.
To Richard Vaughan Live, an English class, a special English class, where we look at the language, dissect it, use it, improve it, and enjoy it. A different type of class, a class for people like you, for people who agree to be an accomplice together with Richard Vaughan in the delightful crime of learning English. Stop knocking and open the door to learning English.
Hello again and welcome back. Welcome to our second half hour of today's Wednesday edition of Richard Vaughan Live. Yes, sir. I was talking about the simple past and the present perfect. I also spoke about the verb to dwell on a subject. We use this often, eh? This is not obscure. Obscure. Que suene la B. Obscure. Obscure is the best way in English to say rebuscado. Una palabra rebuscada. Obscure. Isn't that obscure? We use it to dwell. To dwell on the subject means to stop and to talk at length about the subject. El tema. At length means detenidamente. I've learned when you stop and you talk at length about a subject, you're dwelling on that subject. But usually we use the verb not in a negative way, but to say, come on. We shouldn't be dwelling on this subject for so long. Let's go on to point number three. Albert Einstein, when was he born? Well, he was born before I was born. Did he die before you were born? No, he didn't die before I was born. He died in 1955. Well, how old were you, Richard, when Albert Einstein died? Well, probably I was 3 years old. Why probably? Well, because I was born in November 1951, which means that I was still, for me to be 4 years old when he died, that means Einstein would have had to have died, habría tenido que morir, would have had to have died after November 9th, 1955, which is unlikely, but we can look it up. Let's look it up. Albert Einstein. Einstein. Now, he was a physicist. Yes, sir. Let's see. He died when? He was only 1.70 meters. He was a pretty short guy. Let's see. What was the date of death? April. So I was 3 years old when he died. How old was Einstein when he died? He was 76. He didn't take care of himself. He was 76, but he didn't take care of his appearance, because if you look at his face, I'm looking at a picture of him taken in 1947. Now, in 1947, he was 68, probably. All right, 68, and he looks like he's 85. So he didn't really take care of himself. He didn't care, I guess. He was too busy thinking up things. He was teaching. He died in Pennsylvania. Excuse me, in Pennsylvania. He died in New Jersey. He was a professor at Princeton. He was born in Germany. Ulm. All right. He was German. Although he spent a lot of years in Switzerland. In Zurich. In other places. Brilliant man. Mr. Einstein. He died, he lived for 76 years, and he's been dead since 1955, which means he's been dead for 67 years, right? 68 years. All right. Is he one of the most important people in history? I wouldn't. Yes, I would definitely include him in the top 50, maybe in the top 20. I don't know. That said, to make a list of the most important people in history, it depends on your definition of the word important, because I guess the best measure of the importance is the person who had the greatest influence on the way the world is today. And that would be, my God, the person who had the greatest influence on the way we live today. A lot of people. I mean, Louis Pasteur, you know, he developed cures for rabies, and he was the person who brought medical attention to bacteria and to microbes and to infectious diseases. Very important person. Christopher Columbus, of course. I mean, for me, one of the most interesting questions is how much later would the New World have been discovered by the Europeans if Christopher Columbus had died on his first voyage? If the three ships, the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria, if they had all sunk in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, how long would it have taken the Europeans to realize that there's an entire, or two large continents straight west, directly to the west? Because in English, remember, in the English-speaking world, North America and South America are separate continents. That is very interesting. If Columbus, he discovered the New World for the Europeans in 1492, October 12th, 1492. Now, when would the New World have been discovered? 1592? 100 years later? Probably sooner. But you know, I don't think, as far as my knowledge of history, I don't think there was a big, there was a lot of pressure to sail west, to find a western route to the Spice Islands and the Indies. The Spice Islands are basically some of the islands in Indonesia. Las Islas de las Especias. The Spice Islands, which were discovered by the Portuguese and then the Dutch. The Dutch. But I think the first Portuguese, of course, the first Portuguese voyagers, Vasco da Gama, but before him was Bernal, his name was Diaz. I can't remember his first name. I can't remember his first name. Yes. Portuguese explorer. His name was Diaz, or Diaz with an S. Bartolomeu Diaz, all right, was a Portuguese mariner and explorer. Mariner is an old word, marino, marinero. Mariner, we don't use that word in now. We say a sailor. Sailor is marinero. Yo no soy marinero, soy capitán. I'm not a sailor, but the old word is mariner. There's a very famous poem in the English language called The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. La Rima del Antiguo Marinero. It's interesting because the word ancient, because no es el viejo marinero. No, no. It says, it's not the rhyme of the old mariner. It's the rhyme of the ancient mariner. It's a very interesting story, to tell you the truth. And it's interesting. It's the Samuel Taylor Coleridge, a very famous British English poet from the early, very late 18th century, early 19th century, during a period of poetic flourishing in England, with Lord Byron, Percy Bysshe Shelley, and Keats, I can't remember the name, William Wordsworth, and many others. And one of them was Samuel Taylor Coleridge. And his two most famous poems, one was Kublai Khan, The Palace of Kublai Khan. And the other was the Rime of the Ancient Mariner. And it's a long poem. It's an epic poem. And it takes place in, I think it's in London, or it's in a city in England, probably London. And a man and his family, I think, are well-dressed, walking to the church because they have to attend a wedding. And so they're walking through the streets of London to attend a wedding. And an old man approaches them. And he says, I have a story to tell you. And this old man manages to stop them, and they stay. They don't go to the wedding, and they listen to this man telling the story, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. It's a really, really interesting poem, because it's a story. Yes. And of course, for you to read the poem would be very difficult, because the poetry is very rich in its vocabulary and its alliteration and its symbolism and things. It is an ancient mariner, and he stoppeth one of three. By thy long gray beard and glittering eye, now wherefore stopped thou me? Wow. Tu se tutean in English. El tuteo, which people don't use now. But it says, he stoppeth. It's third person singular in the older English. One of three. By thy long gray beard and glittering eye, por tu barba larga de blanca, y tu ojo resplandeciente, porque me has parado tú. Yeah. Now, wherefore stoppest thou me? The bridegroom's doors. It's the wedding. He said, las puertas de la iglesia están abiertas, y yo soy uno de los parientes. And I am next of kin. The guests are met. The feast is set. Mayest hear? Can't you hear the merry din? But the guy he insists, and he tells the long story. My God, it's long, but it's a very interesting story, by the way. If there, I imagine there's a good, translation into, in Espanol. Let me see if I can find it. Then I would recommend that you read this poem, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. Let me see if I can find. Relata la fantástica aventura de un marinero durante un largo viaje en el mar. Okay, fine. Yeah, but I want to find it in español, in Spanish. Escuche la rima del antiguo marinero. Ver sus ojos mientras detiene uno de los tres. Mesmerices, uno de los invitados a la boda. Quédate aquí, escucha las pesadillas del mar. It's a strange, mesmerizar. I don't think this verb exists. It exists in English, to mesmerize. And it's very common, by the way. To mesmerize. But I don't think it exists in Spanish. But the translator, mesmerizar, es el resultado de utilizar como método psicoterapéutico una fuerza magnética para controlar el cuerpo. Con el tiempo, el mesmerismo derivó en la hipnosis. All right. So it exists, but I think most people in Spain probably don't know this word. But it's about mesmer. He was a German, mesmerism, animal magnetismo animal, animal magnetism, also known as mesmerism. All right. And it was developed by Franz Mesmer. And Franz Mesmer was a German physician, doctor, with an interest in astronomy. And we use this. This is the precursor. Mesmerism is the precursor of hypnosis. And we use the verb in English to mesmerize in the same way that we use it hypnotize. In English, to hypnotize is more direct by a psychiatrist or a psychotherapist, psychoanalyst can hypnotize you. But to mesmerize it, me quedé hipnotizado. Me quedé patidifuso, sometimes you say. That's, I was mesmerized. And so we use it a lot in English. Mesmerized. But I didn't know there was a verb mesmerizar in Spanish, and they use it here. But the rhyme of the ancient mariner, but I'm talking about Christopher Columbus. The question is, it was clear that the Far East was a very high potential place on the map in the world for exploration and exploitation, because the Portuguese, under Bartolomeu Dias, and then Vasco de Gama, they had managed to go down the coast of Africa and to go around the coast of Africa, the Cape of Good Hope. And Vasco de Gama, I believe, managed to reach India. And I think he was the person who founded the community of Goa in India. Goa. Es un estado de la República de la India. All right. Ciudad, soy ciudad poblada. Y ciudad más poblada se llama Vasco da Gama. Vasco da Gama. All right. I think it was discovered, I think, by los primeros indios arios establecieron en Goa. Yes. But Vasco da Gama. Colonización portuguesa. In 1498, Vasco da Gama dobló el Cabo de Buena Esperanza y llegó ahí. All right, fine. It's a long story. But it's... And then soon the Portuguese were going all the way to Japan. But not before Christopher Columbus discovered the New World. But it was clear that in the East, Oriente Lejano, in the Far East, there was a lot of potential wealth. So it was clear that the world was round. I mean, intelligent people knew that the world was round. The question was, in the time of Christopher Columbus, of all of the readings I've made, I haven't investigated or I haven't researched to what extent other people, other than different from Christopher Columbus, were also proposing sailing west. I just don't know. I have the impression that he was the only. Yes. Did others besides Columbus propose sailing west? I don't really know. And I can't find it. How many other people? Let me formulate the question. How many other people proposed sailing west to reach the Indies? I can't find the age of discovery, etc. I can't find it. But I have a feeling that Christopher Columbus was one of the only people who was proposing to sail west to reach the Far East, to reach the Indies, las Indias, se decía a la sazón, the Indies. And so if he had failed in his first voyage, if his three ships had disappeared on the way crossing the Atlantic, I think it would have been at least maybe 30 or 40 or 50 years before another adventurer or another mariner or seafarer would have proposed sailing west. I don't really know. But it's an interesting question. It's a question we'll never know. But if you have the time, I think it's very good to research to see if Christopher Columbus had any competitors. Did Christopher Columbus have any competitors? Other adventurers or explorers who were determined to sail to the west? I don't think so. But in any case, Christopher Columbus died in 1506. He died 2 years after Isabella, the first of Castile. She was the one who supported him. Yes. You know, it's not true, but it's a very interesting conspiracy theory that Isabella Católica, Isabella, the first of Castile, was secretly in love with the father of Christopher Columbus. And that's why she insisted with her husband, Ferdinand of Aragon, to provide the financing for the expedition or the journey to the New World. Why? Well, the story is the following, that when Isabella was a little girl, she met Carlos de Viana, Príncipe de Viana, who was the elder son of King John of Aragon. You see, Ferdinando el Católico, was the younger son, but quite a bit younger, maybe 25 years younger than Carlos de Viana. And Carlos de Viana was the older son by a different marriage, so they were half-brothers. They were not full brothers. They were half-brothers. But Carlos de Viana and his father had big problems, and the father disinherited him and passed on the throne to his younger son, Ferdinand. And the prince, Carlos de Viana, spent, I think, most of the last years of his life in the kingdom of Navarre, I can't remember the name of the town, very famous town in Navarre. I can't remember. However, they say that Isabella met him when she was a little girl and became, she just puppy love. Puppy love means amor de cachorrín, o en cachorra en este caso, and she was just in love with him. And there was a period of time in which Carlos de Viana was exiled to the island of Mallorca, and he was under house arrest, bajo arresto domiciliario, on the island, fíjate, ¿cuál es? Una isla se dice on the island of Mallorca, or Menorca, I think it was Mallorca. And there was a young lady, a young teenage girl who served him the food and things, and she became his concubine, and they had a son. And that son was Christopher Columbus. Now, Isabella of Castile was aware of this. And later, Christopher Columbus became a mariner or a seafaring person. And so when many years later, when he went to Granada to speak to and to Cordoba, they were in Cordoba and Granada, to speak to the Catholic monarchs, she was open to the idea because of that. So one of the theories is that Christopher Columbus is from the island of Mallorca. And in fact, Fray Bartolomé de las Casas said at one time that he heard Christopher Columbus speaking to two other men in perfect Mallorquin. And so I don't know about that. The theories are, of course, that he was from Genoa in Italy. Another is that he was Portuguese, because his wife was Portuguese. And another is that he was from Pontevedra. And finally, the fourth is that he was from Mallorca. Now, 2 years ago, or 3 years ago, in the newspapers, I remember seeing an article that said that they were going to perform a DNA testing, ADN, on the bones of Christopher Columbus's son to try to establish, if they could, his origin. But I never read it. I never heard anything after that. And I've looked it up on the internet. I still can't find, you know, that they have actually made a study. I have a tendency to believe in the Pontevedra conspiracy theory, although most historians insist that he was from Genoa. And so, and he was Italian. But he never spoke Italian. And he never wrote in Italian. And in his writings, there was a little bit, his writings in Castilian Spanish, of course, were very similar. That you could notice there were certain types of Galicis was from Galicia. And so, maybe he was from Pontevedra, but I've run out of time to speculate no more. Maybe tomorrow. Take care.
Escúchanos en cualquier momento y en cualquier lugar. Descarga la app de Vaughan Radio.
Que tus hijos se aburren en el campamento de verano es porque no los has enviado con Vaughan. Porque si buscas un campamento en el que se diviertan, pero de verdad, donde además hablen en inglés todo el rato, tráelos a nuestros campamentos de verano Vaughan en España. Tenemos un montón de destinos disponibles. Para este verano, reserva ya la plaza de tus hijos en los campamentos de verano de Vaughan en el 91-133-5832 o en grupovaughan.com o en tu delegación más cercana.
¿Estás pensando en apuntar a tus hijos a clases de inglés? Seguro que cuando se lo dices piensan,
¡madre mía, clases, qué rollo!
Que no, que en el Club Junior de Vaughan vas a aprender